Who keep KPFT on the air and free for everyone. You have the power. Connect to 526-5738 or go to kpft.org today.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community media, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories that may have slipped under your radar. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
Just a reminder, the last day for you to be actually, so you know it, registered for the general election in Texas is October 11th, which is kind of sneaking up on us. That's less than 2 weeks now. So if you know you're registered, just go to the Secretary of State's website and make sure. Mm-hmm. And if you're not registered, take care of that business now, because votes have consequences.
Yep.
All right. First story, the city of Conroe creates urban forester position from communityimpact.com. On August 25th, the Conroe City Council passed a new vegetation ordinance. The new ordinance includes amendments to the prior ordinance to include a longer list of allowed or permitted trees, as well as a simplified process for administering permits. The Conroe City Council has since agreed to creating an urban forester position to carry out a recent vegetation ordinance to benefit the city as someone who would be in charge of enforcing the ordinance. The role will not need additional funds set aside for it due to an enforcement fund established within the new ordinance. Enforcement funds come from fines the city imposes on someone who violates the ordinance. The council said they would like to enforce the vegetation ordinances more heavily, which means no longer waiving fines for violations. Now, my take on this, it's one of those things that sounds like they did a good environmentally responsible thing, but I suspect a subtext here. In an age of rising CO2 hothouse gases and ongoing air pollution, it sounds like this would be an appealing and forward-looking idea, but I'm going to try to connect some dots here. We have previously discussed articles on this show about communities like Montgomery and Conroe trying to prevent developers from shrinking residential lots to a more affordable and profitable size. One of the arguments city councils have made against shrinking lots has been concerns expressed about fewer trees on the smaller lots after development, which would probably be the case. More structures per acre simply means less space for trees. Now we have an urban forestry position in Conroe with stronger enforcement for violation of the vegetation ordinances. Would the effect be to fine developers for violating the vegetation ordinances by creating new undersized lots without the socio-political implications of actually outright banning them? Maybe I'm just cynical, but I'm also curious. Andrew?
That is a very interesting theory, and it's certainly possible. But to counter your cynicism and take the new ordinance at face value for a little bit, I like that Conroe is thinking about preserving plant life. I hope that the urban forester is empowered and inclined to not only make sure that trees and other plants are present, but that they're native species as well. Not letting developers just plop down the cheapest plants they can find will help promote biodiversity, reducing the chances of ecological disaster, even if by a small amount.
A fair take. Our next story is from communityimpact.com. Houston announces second gun buyback program scheduled for October 8th. Leaders with the City of Houston, Harris County, and the Houston Police Department announced plans for a second gun buyback event to take place October 8th, giving residents the chance to anonymously trade in guns they no longer want in exchange for gift cards. The October 8th event is scheduled to take place at the West Chase Park and Ride at 11050 Harwin Drive, Houston, between 8 a.m. and noon, though Police Chief Troy Finner said, boy, you know, that's the first time I think I've seen that name, said the end time may be extended if the event again attracts large crowds. The city is boosting manpower and the number of car lanes in use for the event to accommodate more people. So drive up, dump your gun line. Unlike the first event, the city will not provide gift cards for privately manufactured guns, which are also called ghost guns or 3D printed guns. Participants can turn those guns in, but they will not receive anything for them. The gun buyback event is part of Houston's One Safe Houston plan to lower crime in the city. The city has dedicated $1 million in total to the gun buyback program, with funds coming from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. At the September 26 news conference, Turner said if the city has taken one gun off the street that would have later been stolen or used to kill someone, the initiative will have been worth it. Yeah, the last time they didn't leave out the 3D printed guns, which or privately manufactured for that matter, which don't have any serial numbers or registration marks or anything like that. So this time they're trying to plug one of those loopholes. Andrew?
Well, I'm going to get directly onto the point in just a minute, but first, the mention of combating crime in the article compels me to point out that crime, specifically the murder rate, is rising around the country in both urban situations like Houston and rural areas at about the same rate, regardless of how tough on crime the local prosecutor is or how much money is spent on policing there. My source for this claim is linked in the blog post for this episode at thinkwingradio.com. The point that I'm making is that gun control and broken windows policing are not going to lower crime rates. Policies that provides people's basic needs so that they don't feel the need or desire to commit crimes will. Now, with all that said, I do support these gun buybacks, specifically so that people who don't want their guns anymore, for whatever reason, maybe they've had a kid, have a theoretically safe and publicly accountable place to get rid of them. Now, I don't know about not giving anything at all for homemade guns, though, because materials and labor will have gone into them, and somebody might decide they'll just keep their homemade gun, or worse, throw it in the trash, if they're not going to recoup at least some of that cost. Though, I will say, I do kind of understand where they're coming from on this, because there is something of a historical precedent of establishing a buyback or a bounty program, and then people gaming that for their own personal gain. There's a few instances in medieval history of local towns having bounties on hunting pests, like in one case it was beavers in the local church, that they would hire local folks to go and trap them and then return the tails or whatever as proof that they'd caught them. And what they found out was
preventing tall tales.
And what they found out was that some people were actually breeding those pests in order to ensure that they still had the opportunity to go catch them and, or well, even just not release them, just take the tails off and go hand them in for money. So they scrapped the bounty program, but everybody released the pests. So it's that sort of line of thinking, I think, that they're trying to avoid here. And I understand that, but I think that there is a risk with that.
I once had a theory that the best way to drive cockroaches extinct was to find an economic purpose for them. But now you've sort of made me reconsider that then people would just start breeding cockroaches and the ones that escaped would continue pestering us.
Well, what you have to do, because there's a bunch of people out there who are trying to make bug meat a viable food source. So what you have to do is you have to find an economically viable use for them so that they're too valuable to
Kentucky Fried Cockroach.
I would not try that. I have enough fears around bugs.
I have to tell you, they have been trying to persuade people in the United States to eat bug burgers at least since I was like in the second grade. Because I remember once getting a weekly reader that was trying to make enticing the idea of bee burgers.
Mm.
And it didn't catch on then either.
Yeah, I mean, no judgment to people who are into that. I'm just not.
Yeah, I've got cockroach jokes, though, and I just don't have time for them right now. Okay, from HoustonPublicMedia.org, Houston Area Appraisal District, known as HCAD, changing its name in 2023. It's going to be changed to HCAD, but there's more to the story. The board members voted to rename the Harris County Appraisal District as the Harris Central Appraisal District in order to extinguish the entity from county government, which I admit I was probably thinking on some level. The headline is self-explanatory. It doesn't need any more explanation, but the main details are that it will still be called HCAD and the website will still be hcad.org. Andrew, you have anything you want to add on that?
Just that you said extinguish rather than distinguish, which is a fun slip of the tongue, but
yeah, well, taxes, extinguish taxes. Yeah, that should be a placard. Okay. From NBCDFW.com, and this is a story I'm sure you've heard versions of. This is just one that I decided I liked. Texas AG Ken Paxton quashes subpoenas he apparently ran from on Monday. Texas's Republican Attorney General says he ran because an unidentified strange man yelled, charged at him outside his home. A process server says he called the Attorney General by name after leaving a business card. And the story goes, Texas Attorney General Paxton quashed a subpoena Tuesday that apparently caused him to run from his home as a process server tried to deliver documents that would have compelled him to testify in an abortion access case. Tuesday morning, federal judge Robert Pittman granted a motion to quash the subpoena for Paxton's testimony after the AG argued that the subpoenas had not been effectively served and neither of them was proper. Actually, neither of them were proper. In his filing, that's just, you know, sick. In his filing, Paxton said none of the requisites for forcing him to testify had been satisfied and that as a high-ranking government official, he was not subject to their subpoena. That's a very Trumpian legal position, by the way. Paxton was also granted a motion to seal two of the filings that contained his address, understandable, saying that public disclosure of the Attorney General's home address put his family at risk. Probably. The filings, which were also obtained by NBC5, had been publicly accessible for several hours, which means eternity on the internet. Paxton was indicted in 2015 on state securities fraud charges in 2015, folks, but has yet to face trial amid long delays over where the felony case should be heard and payment for the special prosecutors. Delay, delay, delay. The FBI is investigating Paxton over allegations of corruption that eight of his own deputies leveled at him 2 years ago. The Texas State Bar has also brought a lawsuit seeking to discipline Paxton for allegedly misleading the U.S. Supreme Court in his suit seeking to challenge Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election. Paxton has broadly denied wrongdoing and remained popular among GOP voters. Of course. He faces Democratic challenger Rochelle Garza, a first-time candidate and former ACLU attorney in the November election. Garza tweeted, "Texans deserve an AG who will uphold the law, not run from it. Texans deserve..." Oh, actually, that's because I already read that. You know, this reminded me, and this is just sort of a cinematic allusion, because I do that sometimes. The Magnificent Seven from 1960, there's a Mexican bandito who for the moment has gained the upper hand on the Seven, and the Seven are about to leave the Mexican village, and Calvera says this, and I can't read it as well as Eli Wallach said it, so don't even imagine. "You'll do much better on the other side of the border. There you can steal cattle, hold up trains. All you have to face is sheriff, marshal. Once I rob a bank in Texas, your government got after me with the whole army, whole army. One little bank. Is clear the meaning? In Texas, only Texans can rob banks." And by this logic, Ken Paxton must be a true Texan. Andrew?
Let's acknowledge for the minute that for anyone else, there is room to argue that being served a subpoena can be confusing. For Paxton, an alleged legal professional who should know what subpoenas are,
he knew exactly,
and how one is served them, there is no excuse. I think he ran from the server and used every loophole he could to wriggle out of the subpoena in court.
The server had apparently been there for an hour, announced who he was. It's not like he thought that this was some, or it's not, I can't put myself in Paxton's head, okay? But I don't think he had a reasonable reason, if that's, you know, not redundant, to anticipate that this person was threatening. I mean,
yes.
If he was willing to do the right thing, he could have just said, "Okay, leave it by the door and step away and I'll pick it up.
Yeah.
That would have been a perfectly reasonable option. Or tape it to the door, and after you leave, I'll take it in. And, you know, all of those things would be perfectly reasonable things for an attorney general or any lawyer worth his salt, which means not someone Trump hires, that they would know how to work this out. But what he was doing was he was evading this guy. I mean, he was obviously evading. We've seen all this on TV and in movies when people don't want to be served and the lengths that some very creative cinema servers will go to. Yeah. This guy obviously wasn't willing to go down Paxton's chimney or something.
You know what would have been so sweetly ironic? If he had refused the subpoena on COVID grounds. He had been like, I'm so careful about COVID because it's this big thing. I don't want to risk taking something that you've had your hands on. I don't know where you've been. I don't know what germs you could have.
You know what would have been even better? If a documentarian crew had been following the server kind of like you imagine in What We Do in the Shadows, which would have been even more appropriate, and they had actually filmed this entire interaction from the guy going to the front door to Paxton running in the car while his wife served as wheel person.
Yeah, you couldn't see that. This is a radio, audio, auditory medium, but I just did the hand kiss thing.
Well, you know, the old radio days, they created very visual effects orally. So, yeah, I hope that someone there kind of got it. Okay, our next actually, you'll have to wait for our next story, but it has to do with Puerto Rico and fuel shipments. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 and again now Thursdays at 6. You can also hear the show online at kpft.org. You can podcast it, which I strongly encourage, or you can go to archive.kpft.org and listen to up to 2 months of earlier versions of the show, plus like 100 other archived shows from KPFT. Now, it's always important to remember that every story on this show is heavily excerpted, some even more than others. So I link to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Click on show posts and more at the top of the webpage and find the post for the show or show date. The most recent one will usually be at the top of the blog page anyway. Also, you can check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig. You can look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his accounts.
I sure do. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story is from, I don't have it written down, but it's got a link. Okay, White House says it's pushing to allow Puerto Rico fuel shipment. Biden supports it.
That's from the Washington Post. I moused over the link.
Oh, thank you so much. You see, I'm reading it from paper. Biden supports a waiver to allow the shipment, an official says, but the administration faces bureaucratic hurdles and political pressures. White House officials are pushing federal agencies to quickly approve a legal waiver allowing Puerto Rico to receive a shipment of diesel fuel that is being held off the island's coast, according to a person familiar with the matter. As Puerto Rico reels from Hurricane Fiona and the administration faces continued blowback over the issue, President Biden is personally tracking the matter and supports granting the waiver, according to the person who spoke on condition of anonymity to reflect private discussions. Biden faces a mounting clamor from Congress as well as Puerto Rican leaders to provide an exemption that would let the BP tanker carrying the fuel access an island port. The ship cannot do so because of the Jones Act, a shipping law that requires goods shipped between points in the United States be carried on U.S. flagships in an effort to support U.S. shipping and labor. By the way, the same thing applies to airlines. If you are flying, let's say, from Houston to Beijing, if you're stopping off at LAX, you have to have U.S. pilots piloting that plane until they get to LAX. Then Chinese pilots take over, even if it's a Chinese branded jet. Yeah, so, I mean, there are other examples of this. The ship, called the G.H. Parks, is flagged to the Marshall Islands and departed from Texas. Administration officials say they have no legal authority to provide a blanket one-year waiver to the Jones Act, as a group of House Democrats demanded in a letter last week. Instead, White House aides are pushing the Homeland Security and Transportation Departments to expedite a review that would allow them to grant a one-time exemption for this particular vessel. A spokesman for BP said a waiver request had been submitted last week. Island advocates have emphasized that the administration granted a waiver to the Jones Act after a Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack led to outages in May, saying there is no reason a similar waiver could not be granted in this case. To comply with federal law, the DHS secretary must ensure Jones Act waivers meet specific legal criteria before granting the reprieve. Keep in mind, this is a legislative order. This is not like an executive decision. First, DHS must determine that waiving the Jones Act is necessary in the interest of national defense, though the law does not define the term. Second, the federal government must determine that no available domestic vessel could meet the same need as the foreign vessel requesting the waiver. While the sight of a fuel tanker idling off the coast is infuriating to many on Puerto Rico and in Congress, the administration faces complex political cross-currents. The American Maritime Partnership, a coalition that represents operators of U.S.-flagged vessels and unions covered by the Jones Act, said Monday that domestic ships were continuing to provide fuel to the island, making a waiver unnecessary. Officials from the group on Tuesday highlighted a radio interview by the executive director of the Puerto Rico Ports Authority, in which he said there is enough diesel fuel on the island. Biden, who in the past has declared unwavering support for the Jones Act and pledged to be the most pro-union president in history, has won plaudits from labor leaders for defending the century-old law and the U.S. jobs it supports. Now, you know, there is always a media outrage machine. And I thought it would be useful to actually discuss what the Jones Act is and briefly why we have the Jones Act. Technically, it's part of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. This is from Wikipedia. The Merchant Marine Act of 1920 is a U.S. federal statute that provides for the promotion and maintenance of the American Merchant Marine. Among other purposes, the law regulates maritime commerce in U.S. waters and between U.S. ports. It requires that all goods transported by water between U.S. ports be carried on ships that have been constructed in the United States and that fly the U.S. flag, are owned by U.S. citizens, and are crewed by U.S. citizens and U.S. permanent residents. The act was introduced by Senator Wesley Jones. The law also defines certain seamen's rights. The national security purpose originated because one of the primary impetuses for the law was the situation that occurred during World War I, when the belligerent countries withdrew their merchant fleets from commercial service to aid in the war effort. This left the U.S. with insufficient vessels to conduct normal trade impacting the economy. Later, when the U.S. joined the war, there were insufficient vessels to transport war supplies, materials, and ultimately soldiers to Europe, resulting in the creation of the United States Shipping Board. The U.S. engaged in a massive shipbuilding effort, including building, and this is true, concrete ships. Yes, you can make a concrete ship float to make up for the lack of U.S. tonnage. The Jones Act was passed in order to prevent the U.S. from having insufficient maritime capacity in future wars. FYI, the concrete ships as a class were called Liberty ships. You can look them up. There were actually some still being used for shipping into the early 1950s. Andrew?
I may be misremembering, but I'm pretty sure I've seen a picture of one being an aircraft carrier, but I suppose it could have been. Because they had aircraft carriers.
Actually, the aircraft carrier thing you may be thinking of, they actually considered turning icebergs into aircraft carriers.
Huh. Okay. That may be.
There was like a way of mixing. Some guy developed sawdust into water and then freezing it or letting it freeze in the Arctic and then, you know, doing stuff with it. It would be a very cold ship to go to the bathroom in. But yeah. It wouldn't use a lot of fuel. It could be towed. It could be used as a stationary anchored platform. It was never actually used, but they did a lot of research on it. But anyhow, I'm sorry. You may continue.
Yeah, that reminds me of the research that the Brits were doing World War II, I think, to build ships out of ice and see how long they could last. But we're getting off on a tangent.
It's what we do, and it makes the show interesting.
Okay, so both Puerto Rican officials and community members are indicating, as far as I've read, that the fuel is needed. But I agree that the Jones Act is important for labor and, secondarily, for maintaining U.S. supply lines. So I think the one-time waiver, for the GH Parks makes the most sense here and should be issued as soon as possible.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. It's not like we're asking for a permanent repeal or a one-year waiver. This is a one and done. And
yeah,
I think politically and also psychologically, for the purposes of the traumatized people on Puerto Rico, it is not an unreasonable thing to ask or to do for them. Okay, and then just generally, I thought it would be worth mentioning this. You've got Hurricanes Fiona and Hurricane Ian, which is getting ready to hit Florida. It's already hit Puerto Rico. It's hit Cuba. So I've got some headlines here that I singled out. Fiona damage widespread in eastern Canada. Thousands evacuate as Hurricane Ian nears Florida. All of Cuba loses power. Cuba suffers total electrical outage as Hurricane Ian roars through. And then from the New Yorker, Hurricane Maria never finished leaving us. The aftermath of Fiona in a Puerto Rican town, where the quote goes on, you're seeing the most dramatic display of inequality, a Puerto Rican teacher and independence activist said after Fiona. It hurts. So
the three previous stories were all from the Washington Post.
Yes. Thank you. So this is turning into a cataclysmic hurricane season. It's not the first. It probably won't be the last. Under normal circumstances, the U.S. would probably at least offer aid to Canada if they wanted it, possibly even Cuba, which I would favor under normal circumstances. But Florida is at risk of devastating damage. Puerto Rico is literally more than overdue for billions of dollars in aid and billions of dollars in infrastructure assistance that the Trump regime just never bothered dispersing after Congress allocated it. In early 2019, and there had been a number of storms for the couple of years leading up to that, a few hurricanes and tropical storms, I drove along I-10 to Florida and then down Florida's Turnpike. That took me along the coast of East Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Western Florida. Now, this was not some immediate aftermath. This was the hurricanes that hit months or in some cases years ago. And the damage over those past several years was astonishing. It was still visible. There were areas of trees that were just clear cut because they'd all been knocked down by the storms. There were rest areas that were closed and new rest areas that were either under construction or being built. And, you know, now I hear just 3 years later, I hear about this storm coming up West Florida, and I visualize that trip. And I mean, it's just, if you haven't seen it, if you haven't been through a storm, and of course, if you've been through a hurricane, you take a very, very personal view. When you're sort of traveling through a number of hurricane devastated areas, it starts to give you a little broader perspective that you can actually begin to contemplate.
Yeah.
In some places, it looked like people and even states had given up on full recovery. Resources had just run out. Areas of Houston and the surrounding area have been similarly affected by severe weather. And, you know, the question going forward a lot is going to be, how can humans protect themselves from this ongoing challenge? Andrew?
Well, there are still plenty of places along the Gulf Coast that haven't fully recovered from Katrina.
And new tarp houses.
Yeah. That was in, what, 2005, 2008, somewhere around there?
Somewhere around there.
So
it must have been about 2005 because I was working at Sears at the time selling appliances. And I remember a lot of people coming from Louisiana temporarily/permanently settling in Houston because I was selling a lot of appliances to them.
Yeah. And I think Bush was the one who got the criticism back then.
Yes. So
it must have been during.
Heck of a job.
Yeah. Anyway, the other obstacle to recovery from Hurricane Maria that Puerto Rico is facing is the federally imposed, and let's see, that's by the PROMESA Act of 2016, I believe. I don't remember whether that's the twilight years of Obama's term or the sunrise years, I guess, of
2016 would have to be the end of Obama, because Trump, not until 2017, God help us.
Good point. The PROMESA Act imposed on Puerto Rico the Financial Control Board. The FCB is supposed to be getting Puerto Rico out of debt, but instead has chosen to try to accomplish that through major funding cuts to and privatization of public services, as well as reducing worker pay and benefits on the island. These are all policies that will and are causing significant harm to the people of Puerto Rico. Disaster recovery is not just rebuilding destroyed structures, it's also rebuilding lives. And austerity measures like these tear lives down in the name of repaying exploitative creditors. Not to mention, many of these policies have been opposed by the people of Puerto Rico and the local government. So all this adds up to a dire situation on the island that is only made worse with every global warming intensified hurricane season. Now, I would like to see some assistance offered to Canada and Cuba, but I agree that the federal government's priority right now must be releasing the aid money Puerto Rico is due, not to the Financial Control Board, but to the Puerto Rico government directly. Also, rerouting a few billion dollars from defense spending into nationwide disaster recovery and preparedness, I think, should be next on the agenda.
Well, I'm sure we have military bases on Puerto Rico, so, you know, the money flows.
We can justify it.
We can, yeah. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show live on kpft.org when it's being broadcast. You can podcast it, which is my suggestion. You can also go to archive.kpft.org, where we have prior shows that are on there generally for a couple of months after broadcast, as well as dozens, if not 100 more shows that are also broadcast on KPFT that you can access there. KPFT does have over 100 show titles, and to do that means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage, which is actually now periodically updated, and hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, Think Wing Radio perhaps, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you may even qualify for a lovely thank you gift. And, you know, spreading the word helps us too, and it's free. You tell two people, and they tell two people, and so on and so on and so on. Okay, our next story. This is from commondreams.com via salon.com. Coming soon, Laura Boebert, MTG, which is Marjorie Taylor Greene, I believe, lead GOP celebrations over the rise of fascism in Europe. According to Steve Scalise, we need to bring that kind of conservatism to the United States. As much of the world watched with alarm as the fascist Fratelli d'Italia party led a far-right coalition to victory in Italy on Sunday, Republican lawmakers in the United States had a much different reaction, open glee. Pointing happily to the far-right's election surge in Sweden, U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, tweeted that, quote, the entire world is beginning to understand that the woke left does nothing but destroy. November 8th is coming soon, and the USA will fix our House and Senate, added Boebert, a loyalist to former U.S. President Donald Trump. Let freedom reign, she said. U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican, Georgia, a far-right ally of Boebert's, I wonder if she's further right the way they frame that, in the U.S. House, also applauded Sunday's results, which positioned Fratelli d'Italia leader Giorgia Meloni to become Italy's next prime minister, even though her party won just 25% of the vote in a low turnout contest. So, you see, parliamentary systems have their flaws, too. Congratulations.
Low turnout.
Low turnout, but still just 25% of the low turnout, and she's going to form a government. So, yeah, parliamentary system's not perfect either. Congratulations to Giorgio Meloni and to the people of Italy, Marjorie Taylor Greene wrote on Twitter, misspelling the right-wing leader's first name because, of course. In her post, Greene linked to a, you know, there's a saying, Google before you type is the new think before you speak. In her post, Greene linked to a 2019 speech in which Meloni, who was a youth member of the fascist Italian social movement, railed against supposed attacks on, quote, national identity and, quote, religious identity, and vowed to, quote, defend God, country, and family. Yeah, I can see the family resemblance. U.S. Representative Steve Scalise, Republican, Louisiana, the House Minority Whip, said in a Fox News appearance Sunday, it's interesting to see that Europe is leading the way by throwing out socialists with conservatives and great, bold conservative women like Meloni and U.K. Prime Minister Liz Truss. Yeah, I have a couple of words about Liz Truss we'll get to. We need to bring that kind of conservatism to the United States, Scalise added. U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican, Texas, for his part, of course, hailed as spectacular Meloni's 2019 address to the World Congress of Families, a far-right Christian fundamentalist organization that campaigns against LGBTQ plus rights globally. Meloni is well known to the right wing in the U.S., having spoken at the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, and met with former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, a far-right provocateur who has correctly described Meloni's party, also known as Brothers of Italy, as one of the old fascist parties. He says that like it's a good thing. You put a reasonable face on right-wing populism, you get elected, Bannon said of Meloni in an 2018 interview, a year in which the Brothers of Italy garnered just 4% of the vote. Kasim Rashid, a human rights attorney, wrote on social media late Sunday, quote, Hungary has a fascist leader. Sweden's far-right party just won. And Italy has now elected a fascist leader. 80 years after World War II, fascism is rising across Europe. And if Americans aren't careful, the MAGA GOP will usher in that same fascism here. We cannot let that happen. So I guess one of the first things I'll mention, you know, you've occasionally seen liberals are trying to find some kind of a hook to hang on GOP. I don't even use that anymore. They're Republicans. I'm kind of like, I think it was the Washington Post made a decision that their writers would not use the term GOP, Grand Old Party, unless they were citing something that used the term GOP. Now, what you will sometimes see is people on the left using the term GQP, the Grand Queer Party. I think I have a new variation. The GQP, the Grand Quisling Party. Quislings being named
Quisling.
Yes, basically the was it the Norwegian prime minister who became, it was either Norwegian or Finnish. I think it was Norwegian, who basically became a Nazi collaborator, Nazi sympathizer. He had been a fascist before the war, so he was a perfect choice. And his last name, Quisling, became a noun for someone who basically is a fifth columnist, a traitor to a country within a country.
Hang on a minute. Quisling, I'm looking this up because I'm curious now. Oh,
okay.
Not Arnold Quisling. I was thinking Benedict Arnold and this guy.
Conflation.
Vidkun Quisling. Vidkun Quisling was a Norwegian military officer, politician, and Nazi collaborator who nominally headed the government of Norway during the country's occupation by Nazi Germany during World War II. Thank you, Wikipedia.
You see, the more you know. Da, 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 da. Anyway, so there's that part of it. I think, you know, we really, really need to pay attention to this. You know, I'm not a conservative. I consider myself a moderate liberal. Sometimes I'm a little more left than moderate. Sometimes I'm a little more right than liberal. But basically, I'm a moderate liberal. And I don't agree with conservatives hardly any of the time. But, you know, sometimes they do come up with actual legitimate concerns. Now, we're talking reasonable conservatives, moderate conservatives. I may not agree with their concerns, but sometimes I can see how their concerns are worth addressing to come to a reasonable meeting of the minds.
Broken clock is right twice a day, as the saying goes.
Well, if you will. But, you know, here we're in a situation where these people are so far from being traditional conservatives, philosophical conservatives. We now have a fascist caucus in the Republican Party. Now, they're not calling it a fascist caucus, although I actually at this point suspect that they wouldn't think there's anything wrong with calling it a fascist caucus. They really should just form it and, you know, transparency. They talk about transparency sometimes. I think it would be very transparent if they formed a fascist caucus in the House and a fascist caucus in the Senate, just to be truth in advertising. Yeah, this is appalling stuff. If this doesn't scare the CR asterisk P out of you, I don't know what will. I also, by the way, I liked this article because it provided some quotes. I do have a reference link to an article from Al Jazeera, which is a little more journalistically typical and also very informative. Just wasn't as much fun to read. So there's that also. Andrew?
Well,
Quislings.
Yeah.
Word of the day.
Yeah. You know, I especially in that article, I feel like there is a bit of a risk, as the left sometimes falls into, of the victory being in the victory over the right wing being in pointing out, you know, some minor detail about their messaging rather than, you know, the horrible things that they're doing in power. I think there was,
you're concerned about demonizing the demons, essentially.
No, not about focusing too much on the optics rather than what they're doing. And there's something, it was Marjorie Taylor Greene getting Maloney's first name.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know,
ironic.
Yeah. It's a minor thing. And it's intended to provide a little levity to the story. And I'm not saying that they focus too much on it. I think that it's a good point to talk about this. We need to remember that the battle against fascism is not won by making them look stupid on Twitter. The battle against fascism is won by proving to people
by voting against them.
by proving to people through whatever means possible that their politics are inherently self-destructive and lead to nothing but ruin, right? So with that out of the way, fascism, I believe all of this. I can't say that it's objectively true because it's politics and politics is subjective, but I believe that this is all self-evident. Fascism is taking root because center and center-left status quo politics have proven unresponsive to the needs of the working class. Efforts by the center to demonize the left have encouraged people who are going hungry and sick to reach to the right instead. The center, I think, needs to step back and accept that the only way to defeat repressive, hateful politics that benefit the rich, like fascist politics, is with policies that meet people's needs, give them more freedom of choice, protect marginalized people, and focus on restoring dignity to working people. The center left, I think, needs to look to the far left for leadership here, because fascism won't be beaten back by a promise to return to a normal that enables so much suffering. That's my thoughts.
I disagree mm-hmm. about the center-left looking to the far-left for leadership. I think that it would be useful for the center-left to look to the far-left for ideas. But ultimately, in a democracy so far, you still have to get voters to buy in to your policy ideas.
Yes.
So for the center-left, first of all, I think is a more palatable option for 50.1% of voters, which is what you need in most cases to win an election, or should. On the other hand, I think, for example, that Bernie Sanders, I think, has done invaluable benefits to the Democratic Party and the left in general by being as outspoken as he is about the policies that he talks about. I think he would have made a horrible president. I don't think his personality is suited for it. But, well, you know, sometimes people just have the right job at the right time and the right place to do something important. And I think Bernie Sanders will go down in U.S. history as someone who performed a very important function at a time when the right was really in a very powerful ascendancy.
If I may give you a little bit of information on my point, I would consider Bernie Sanders part of the center left. So that's the framework that I'm coming from. So just
okay,
for your information.
Fair enough. I would call him
solid left.
I would say he is, if you take the entire spectrum from the center to the anarcho-communistic sympathetic,
mm-hmm.
I would say he's at the center of the center.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
I would agree with that.
For most Americans, he would be considered, I mean, my mother,
yeah,
bless her heart, before she died, she actually, you know, she was born in 1922, so it's like through the tail end of the First World War and the Second World War and the communist scare, the Red Scare, and her term for Bernie Sanders was, he's kind of pink, isn't he?
Yeah.
And you know, there's still a lot of that. And I get that because socialism, you can't call something socialism in the United States, even when it's socialism. I mean, I'm half surprised that Social Security is called Social Security.
Yeah.
When you think about it.
Yeah.
And it was called, you know, communism and socialism. And of course, it had social in its name, which probably was not a great, you know, selling point. I think Frank Luntz would have focus grouped that different.
Yeah.
But, I think that the left and socialists have a lot of good ideas. We have in the United States, I've said this many times, I'm not the only one, we have a mixed economy. It has capitalism, it has socialism. It needs things to be in the right balance. You need enough regulation so that capitalists aren't monsters. You need enough regulation so that socialism doesn't devolve into the lowest common denominator in every job and every company. I mean, there is a happy medium that can be struck. As I said to someone about a week ago, I'm a happy medium kind of guy. And of course, that happy medium will tend to drift from place to place, depending on the times you're in and the state of society and technology, et cetera. But in any case, I don't think we're in substantial disagreement, except that you think the far left should lead. I think the far left has ideas that are worth looking at.
Well, if those are our positions, may I suggest a compromise and have the center left at least recognize the far left as equal partners?
I don't think they have to do that. I mean, I think that's what coalitions come and go. You know, it's like sometimes you have the right and the left agree on something. And, you know, I have a saying that agreement does not require that you agree for the same reasons.
Mm.
So, for example, you have liberals who are against the death penalty on conditions of humanity and justice, mm-hmm. and you have conservatives who are against the death penalty just because it takes too long and costs too much.
Mm.
And you know what? At the end of the day, that's okay. They're both against the death penalty.
Mm.
And that's sometimes the magic of constructive politics.
But, yeah, well, in some ways, that's what I was suggesting is, you know, you can be equal partners on issues. And if you find, even if you disagree, even if you are of the same mind for different reasons, you know, you can work together and respect each other to accomplish a goal or a set of goals.
I guess I trip over the phrase equal partners.
Mm.
I mean, equal partners, sure, you want to, if you're discussing something with an opponent, let's say,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to talk down to them. You want to treat them as on your level. You don't want to offend them, insult them, diminish them. But that isn't the same as calling them equal partners. That's treating them as equals, which is a different thing.
Mm, okay. Okay.
But, you know, it's a semantic difference.
It's somewhat, and we need to do the next break. So
yeah, and I do semantics because it's part of why you listen. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio, by the way, with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. and again Thursdays at 6 p.m. You can also hear the show online at kpft.org. You can podcast it on your phone's app. You can visit archive.kpft.org and go through older shows. We heavily excerpt every story on the show, some more than others, which is why we include links to full articles at thinkwingradio.com. It'll almost always be the most recent post for the most recent show. You can also click on show posts and more at the top of the thinkwingradio.com page to find a particular post or show date you're looking for. You can use the search bar. You can use search terms. Search bar isn't extremely big, by the way, with this particular blog template, but it is there. You can also check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. You can leave comments, suggestions, and questions. And you can look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And I believe that Andrew has stuff.
I do. You'd think you'd know by now how often we do these breaks.
I'm just being sort of rhetorical. I mean, I know you have stuff.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm glad that you recognize that. I'm at DominateI on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far-left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's DominateEYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Okay, the next story is from the Washington Post. You've probably heard about it. And, you know, generally, I don't do big stories that everyone is talking about unless I feel I can contribute something a little different. So I think I can. From the Washington Post, European leaders blame Russian sabotage after Nord Stream explosions. European leaders said Tuesday they believed dual explosions that damaged pipelines built to carry Russian natural gas to Europe were deliberate, and some officials blamed the Kremlin, suggesting the blasts were intended as a threat to the continent. Let me flip the page here. Damage did not have an immediate impact on Europe's energy supplies. Russia cut off flows earlier this month. The episode is likely to mark a final end to the Nord Stream pipeline projects. These are deliberate actions, not an accident, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said. The act probably marks the next stage in the escalation of this situation in Ukraine, the Polish prime minister said. Russia denied responsibility for the damage. Five European officials with direct knowledge of security discussions said there was a widespread assumption that Russia was behind the incident. Only Russia had the motivation, the submersible equipment, and the capability, several of them said, though they cautioned they did not yet have direct evidence of Russia's involvement. One official said it might have been a message to NATO. We are close from the Russians. Another said that it could be a threat to other non-Russian energy infrastructure since so many pipelines crisscross the Baltic Sea, including one inaugurated on Tuesday. A third noted that crucial internet data cables lie along the bottom of the sea, and there have been longstanding concerns that Russia has a submersible program that could cut them, causing communications chaos around the world. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday the U.S. was aware of unverified reports that the leaks may be the result of an attack or some kind of sabotage. He went on, if it is confirmed, that's clearly in no one's interest, he told reporters at the State Department. And the story goes on from there. Now, you know, actually, he's right. It is clearly in no one's interest, in my opinion. There's also discussion of the potential environmental damage due to methane acting as a very potent greenhouse gas, and there's a lot of that in the story as well. Aside from an EU consensus that the leaks were caused by sabotage due to detection of explosions, and I'll say we don't know for sure it's even sabotage. We know that they detected explosions, and there are several countries in that region that know what explosions look like versus, say, earthquakes or something like that. So in my view, and if I may coin a phrase, this is kind of like an episode of Methane, She Wrote. Who would really have a motor for this? And who, if anyone, might benefit? The questions, as always, are means, motive, and opportunity. We might also add risk of discovery of guilt. The Western assumption, consensus even, seems to be Russia. I add, of course. But this, and I'm not pro-Russia, but, you know, this is worth a fair-minded evaluation. This seems like an expensive signal for Russia to send without much self-benefit. The pipelines represent a great expense in money and time, and it all but ends, but any hope of gas sales from Russia eventually resuming, if at all. Who else might benefit? Ukraine is a possible suspect. I'm sympathetic to Ukraine, but they might benefit from an even more urgent effort by the Western nations to replace Russian gas. But do they have, or could they hire the resources, especially so far from home? Would they risk being discovered if it was them, and risk turning their allies against them, I think is the biggest question. Now, the U.S. has been strategically opposed to these pipelines since construction started in the 1970s. It's been opposed by every U.S. government since probably Jimmy Carter, at least, maybe Nixon. Could it be a U.S. operation as a final nail in the coffin of strategically disadvantageous Russian gas supplied to important allies? I mean, if we're going to extend the net to its maximum, any large international gas consortium that wants Europe's business could have a possible motive. Answers will develop eventually, but I don't think we should leap to conclusions, and speculating on stories early in their development is always a hazardous enterprise. Andrew?
Well, you know, I agree with pretty much all of what you just said. I'm a little surprised by that, but maybe I shouldn't be. We are Think Wing Radio, meaning we're supposed to think, which clearly nobody who's decided it's Russia with this little evidence has bothered to do. I mean, it's their own pipeline. What, are they blowing it up for the insurance? Like you say, Mike, it'd be an expensive waste without much benefit, and it'd come back to bite them later. We can't rule anything out, of course, but I find the idea that it's a U.S. operation, or a proxy op via one of our allies, much more plausible. Corporate sabotage is also possible, but not mutually exclusive with a U.S. operation.
Well, you know,
We'll just have to see what evidence turns up, assuming it does.
I guess my thought would be that the U.S., while I would not rule them out as motive and certainly not opportunity, I think that risk of discovery would give them the same motive not to do it as it would give Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I think Ukraine has reasons to make Russia look more evil and to detach the West from Europe more.
Yeah.
But I don't think they would risk discovery and alienating all their allies. And I think the U.S. has the same reason not to be the one doing it. Now, if it is the Russians, you know, if you want to send a military message by demonstrating a capability.
Yeah.
As a general rule, you want the message to be clear.
Yeah.
So, for example, we talked the other day. I don't know if we talked about it on the air. I think we did on the last show, that before the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on Japan, there was a lot of discussion at the highest levels. Is that the first thing we want to do with that bomb? We don't have many bombs. I believe we had three. They tested the first one at Los Alamos. They dropped the second one at Hiroshima and the third one on Nagasaki. And while they were building more, they didn't have them handy. And one of the big questions before dropping it on Hiroshima was, if we do a test drop, would that scare the Japanese into surrendering, seeing what this bomb could do? So you like drop it in the Pacific Ocean, not too far from Japan, where it could be seen, but do little or no actual human damage. And the response to that generally was, but we only have the two bombs left. What if that doesn't make them surrender? And ultimately, the choice was, we've got two bombs left. If we're going to get Japan to surrender, we need to use it. So they dropped the first one, and they tested the waters, metaphorically speaking, with Japanese leadership, and that didn't quite do it. And then they dropped the second one, and essentially they ended up with a peace deal that the Japanese had offered for quite a while, which is, we'll surrender unconditionally, except we want to keep the emperor. Mm. And that's how that played out. Mm. But,
you know, but the point is...
To bring the story back around,
yeah,
the point is that dropping the A-bomb in the middle of the Pacific to demonstrate its power, that would have been a clear message.
Yes.
I am not sure what the clear message is if the Russians blew up three parts of their own pipelines.
Yeah, and then didn't claim credit for it, or at least didn't not claim credit for it with the added, you know, bit on the end of, well, we didn't do it, but it sounds like the person that did do it shouldn't be messed with, you know?
and you know, it's not even that clear.
Yeah.
And, you know, just from my limited knowledge of these things, and I'm certainly far from an expert.
Yeah.
And this time I haven't done enough research to say, and I've researched it too. But when you have pipelines going underwater and mm-hmm. you have natural gas going through a pipeline, now, when pipelines are above ground, under the right conditions, a spark near a pipeline will cause an explosion. But mm-hmm. typically there would have to be some kind of a leak for mm-hmm. that to happen, that would then act like a fuse into the main gas line.
Right.
Now, you're talking something I think they said is about 75 meters underwater, which is not deep as seas go, but it's pretty deep.
Yeah.
It's like 225 or so feet.
Yeah.
And there's no oxygen down there, certainly no undissolved oxygen. There shouldn't be any oxygen in the pipeline, because that would be silly.
Yeah.
It would be hard to have a stray spark outside the pipeline, and it would be hard to envision a situation that might create a spark inside the pipeline. Although I will say one thing, mm-hmm. there is a machine, and we're going to run out of time in a moment, but there is a machine used in the industry called a pig. Mm-hmm. It's essentially a robot.
Yes.
And when they want to inspect pipelines from the inside, they send this thing down the pipes, and it looks at x-rays, it looks for flaws, it either welds something or it will report that it needs further work. Now, one possibility that would occur to me is that the Russians perhaps sent a pig down these pipelines, and either intentionally or accidentally it sparked an explosion. But again, then the question of three explosions in three separate pipelines.
Yes.
Still a stretch.
It's, well, yeah, but they could have sent three pigs down.
They could have, and that those could have carried bombs.
And they, So,
but, yeah,
it's possible.
In the fullness of time, as they say.
Yeah, all we've got right now is speculation without much, if any, evidence. And, you know, all we can do is hope that more evidence turns up and we figure out what actually happened.
And in the meantime, we just have fun speculating.
Yeah, so that we can finally close the book on this geopolitical whodunit.
Okay, that's all the time we've gotten then some. You are listening to Think Wing Radio, or have been listening to Think. I'll get this right. You have been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's Community Media 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor is Andrew Ferguson. I hope you enjoyed the show, found it entertaining, informative, and I'll be looking forward to speaking with you again next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late.
Hey y'all, this is Susan, your host of Border Radio on Houston's community station, KPFT. Join us Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 for Border Radio, right after Deadbeat. We will feature some of your favorite independent artists and songs from new artists on the rise. We'll spotlight concerts for the week to come, from in-person shows in our area to live stream events you can enjoy right from home. And Border Radio will keep bringing you the great on-air interviews you've come to expect from KPFT. Mark your calendar for Border Radio, Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, FMHD1 and KPFT.org.
I am Susan, and one of the reasons I've made Houston my home is because of KPFT, after living all over the country. I'm something of a blues hound, and I think KPFT has some of the best blues programming in the country. Please join me in helping this station, which is a treasure for our ears, to survive and thrive. Please call 713-526-5738. Donate now.
What is dedication?
People ask, how your children learn how to ride a bike and you didn't. I just created an environment where they taught themselves and all I had to do was be there.
That's dedication. Visit fatherhood.gov.